Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, December 15th. The big January 6th story you've probably heard in the last day is that the White House Chief of Staff from the day, Mark Meadows, has been held in contempt of Congress with a criminal referral for refusing to testify before the House January 6th committee, right? But the bigger news might be what Mark Meadows already revealed to the committee in documents he turned over before ending his cooperation. We're going to play a 2.5 minute stretch now of Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney reading into the record yesterday text messages to and from Mark Meadows that were sent while the deadly Capitol riot was taking place, while it was actually going on. Now, you've probably heard that some big Fox News hosts, and maybe you heard also Donald Trump Jr., was texting Meadows to get Trump to call the rioters off, right? And you will hear Liz Cheney here read some of those. We've bleeped out the S word where it occurs in two of those texts, so the FCC will let us keep our jobs. But here's a spoiler alert. The most damning bombshell with possible legal consequences for Trump himself comes at the very end in how Meadows replies to some of these texts. Again, this is 2.5 minutes. Here's Republican Congresswoman of Wyoming, Liz Cheney.
Members of Congress, the press, and others wrote to Mark Meadows as the attack was underway. One text Mr. Meadows received said, quote, "We are under siege here at the Capitol." Another, quote, "They have breached the Capitol." In a third, "Mark, protesters are literally storming the Capitol, breaking windows on doors, rushing in. Is Trump going to say something?" A fourth, "There's an armed standoff at the House chamber door." And another from someone inside the Capitol, "We are all helpless." Dozens of texts, including from Trump administration officials, urged immediate action by the president. Quote, "POTUS has to come out firmly and tell the protesters to dissipate. Someone is going to get killed." In another, "Mark, he needs to stop this now." A third, in all caps, "Tell them to go home." A fourth, and I quote, "POTUS needs to calm this down." Indeed, according to the records, multiple Fox News hosts knew the president needed to act immediately. They texted Mr. Meadows, and he has turned over those texts. Quote, "Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy," Laura Ingraham wrote. "Please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished," Brian Kilmeade texted. Quote, "Can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol," Sean Hannity urged. As the violence continued, one of the president's sons texted Mr. Meadows, quote, "He's got to condemn this ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough," Donald Trump Jr. texted. Meadows responded, quote, "I'm pushing it hard. I agree." Still, President Trump did not immediately act.
Wow. Congresswoman Liz Cheney, vice chair of the House January 6th committee. Yesterday, Mark Meadows was trying to get the president of the United States to call off a violent insurrection taking place in his name. And for hours, the president of the United States refused. Let's understand more about this with New York Times congressional correspondent Luke Broadwater, who's covering it. Luke, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just replay the last 10 seconds of that Liz Cheney reading and ask you to put them into context. Here's Cheney again on how Mark Meadows, White House Chief of Staff, replied about getting Trump to call the rioters off.
Meadows responded, quote, "I'm pushing it hard. I agree." Still, President Trump did not immediately act.
So, Luke, what do we learn from that about Donald Trump's role in the attempted violent overthrow of the Congress of the United States as it was taking place?
Well, I think we learn a great deal. We knew there from some initial reporting that there were delays in calling in the National Guard, that Donald Trump had sort of watched the violence unfold on television and did nothing much with it. But these text messages that Liz Cheney revealed this week, I think, brought it home in a new way and added very important details, which was that people, including the president's own son, were demanding that he do more to stop the violence, that he condemn this attack and call off the mob. And one important thing that Liz Cheney is getting at with those comments is there are criminal codes about obstructing an official proceeding of Congress. And that is the charge that we've seen leveled at a lot of the defendants in the criminal cases related to January 6th. And so she is laying out the case for why that charge could be applicable to Donald Trump. And these
let me jump in there because we have the clip that I think you're referring to.
Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
And this is something that I don't think we've heard before. You tell me if this suggestion of a possible crime committed by Trump is a new idea based on this new evidence. Again, Liz Cheney.
Mr. Meadows' testimony will bear on another key question before this committee. Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceedings to count electoral votes?
So, Luke, you want to pick it up again there? Is that the statement by Cheney you were referring to?
Yes. I mean, Liz Cheney has taken on this committee as the biggest, most important assignment of her political career. And so she has dug down into the details of the criminal code. And she is, when she says certain things, it's very meticulous as to what she's talking about. She has talked before about putting President Trump under oath and how if he lies then about election fraud, he will face criminal penalties. Mm. And this is another criminal penalty she's talking about where, the Justice Department so far has found it quite difficult to prosecute charges of insurrection or sedition. They haven't really felt like the evidence is there, despite calls from the public to press those charges. But they have felt like they can prove obstructing a meeting of Congress. And that is not an insignificant charge. It carries something like up to 20 years in prison. And so that seems to be a case the Justice Department is willing to take up. And so Liz Cheney is saying she wants to provide them the roadmap for how that charge could apply to Donald Trump.
So if the committee concludes that Trump, through inaction, corruptly sought to impede Congress's official proceeding to certify the election by passively allowing the insurrection to go on when all these people, including his chief of staff and his son and Fox News hosts, were asking them to do something else, what could the committee do about that?
So one thing the committee can do is at the end of this all, when they're done their investigation, they can make criminal referrals. And we know that they have made two referrals now with the power of the House votes for people who have not cooperated with the investigation. But they could, based on their findings, make referrals in other areas as well. Several members of the committee have said that is something they will look at as they go. So, it remains to be seen. One thing the committee wants to question Meadows about is what he wrote in his book that Donald Trump had ad-libbed the line at the Ellipse that day where he said, "We're going to march to the Capitol and I'm going to join you." And then And then afterwards, as he's coming off the stage, Meadows says that he and Trump discussed this, and Trump says it's metaphorical. So that is something that, that gets to sort of the intent of disrupting Congress, whether it was intended or not. Was it the plan to march on the Capitol? Was it the plan to disrupt Congress? Was it just an ad lib thing? Was staff involved? So those are all the things that the committee wants to ask about.
Yeah, and those things are different, right? Marching on the Capitol is one thing. That can be done peacefully. The violent break-in to the Capitol, the threatening of members of Congress, the people who died in the process, those are different.
Oh, absolutely. And that's been the whole crux of this investigation. And I think sort of the hardest thing for to prove for investigators. So we know it's really well established at this point, based on a lot of evidence, that there was a plan to try to overturn the election, that to not honor the will of the voters, right? Like that there was a plan to put forward this fake slate of electors, to exploit parts of the Electoral Count Act, to have Mike Pence throw out legitimate votes. And those things, as terrible as they are, may not all be illegal. They may be problems in our system that were exposed by people who would rather have Trump in power than a democracy. But the crossover into the violence, I think, is the thing the committee is trying to establish. We know there was some plotting and planning among people who did attack the Capitol. At least that's been alleged by federal prosecutors, with groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. But how much, if at all, were political people involved in those discussions or plans? It seems to date that there hasn't been evidence of that at all. And so if they can connect violence to the planning to overturn the election and the rhetoric used from that stage that day and through tweets and other comments, that's sort of the thing that they're all trying to prove. I don't know if they will be able to establish that. I don't know if that actually happened. It does seem from some of these calls that if there was a plan to attack the Capitol, a lot of people were not in on that, and they were opposed to it. Mm-hmm. As you can see, they're calling and demanding that the violence stop. I think that's the key thing that the investigators are really looking at.
And let's take a call from Jonathan in Bayonne. Jonathan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I appreciate your guest and the work that you both are doing. My concerns on this matter is how much does it, I just would like to have like a timeline. I mean, I understand things are, they do change, but how much this is working into progressing towards potential charges and actually having a result versus the timeline of the elections coming up and what we're dealing with as far as how quickly these things need to happen for things to actually fall in line and produce a result that's going to have some form of justice concerning this matter. I can take my question off the air and have a good day.
Thank you. You have a good day too. Luke?
Yeah, I think the committee is quite aware that their ultimate deadline is probably the end of 2022. There's a belief that the, you know, Republicans will take the House that year, and we will, and this investigation will be shut down. Now, what won't be shut down is any criminal cases that are filed. So the criminal case against Steve Bannon, against Mark Meadows, should the Justice Department charge in that case, those will still remain active. But it does seem clear that if the Republicans take the House, this committee will be dissolved quite quickly. There had been talk initially about the committee releasing a report in the spring of next year, so maybe the March or April timeframe. They are likely going to have televised hearings, maybe as soon as January in prime time.
Oh, really?
To lay out everything they've discovered. But I do also think it's noticed, it's important to set expectations here. This is primarily a legislative committee. Their job is to write an authoritative report about what happened and to recommend changes to existing laws, such as the Electoral Count Act, to prevent such a thing from ever happening again. If in the course of doing that, they discover crimes, or what they believe are crimes, they can refer those to the Justice Department. They can't prosecute crimes themselves. They can't throw people in jail themselves. So it is important for people to understand that this is a congressional committee. They are not a law enforcement operation. And their ultimate job is to recommend changes to laws. It would be a byproduct of the committee if they end up making criminal referrals.
Well, this gets me to the forward-looking question that I wanted to ask, because all of this work by the January 6th committee we've been talking about is backwards-looking. That's their job, I guess, to report on January 6th and what led up to it and try to hold people accountable for it, to the extent, as you were just explaining, that a congressional committee has authority to do that. But the threat to electoral democracy that it involved is potentially ongoing, as many Republican-controlled states are changing their election laws to make it easier to throw out elections that they lose without a violent insurrection. So is the committee dealing with that at all? Or if not them, who in Congress is?
So, you know, that's obviously voting rights is, I would say, a primary concern of congressional Democrats. They have voting right legislation that has all the Democrats in Congress on board with it. Unfortunately for them, it's being blocked by the Republican filibuster in the Senate. And so they feel like they have the solution to those issues at the states on voting rights, but they can't get it passed. And until, as long as the Democrats in the Senate are committed to keeping some Democrats in the Senate are committed to keeping the filibuster in place, I don't see that changing. And so, you know, for most Democrats in Congress, that is something they're very worried about, that these restrictions on voting that Republican states are putting in place are going to deter people from going to the ballot. And they feel like there's not much they can do about it right now.
Yeah. And maybe we even need a different term for it than voting rights. I know it generally gets put in that bucket. But when we say voting rights, the average person who's not following the news really closely thinks of things like, can you get to the polls? Are there enough hours? Is there a poll tax? Are they allowing mail-in ballots? Things like that. But what we're really talking about here is these changes that are allowing state officials to literally overturn the results of elections after people have voted. So I don't know if there needs to be another term for that, or just we need to explain it very clearly. When we're talking about voting rights these days, it includes that, which flows directly from the big lie of January 6th and the popularity of that among the Republican rank and file around the country right now, right?
Yeah, the big lie has introduced, has exposed many problems with our system of democracy, which is at its very core, it's that democracy relies on people, and that people in positions of authority, whether it's sitting on a local elections board, whether it's being the governor of a state, whether it's being a member of Congress, that if they're not willing to uphold democracy, then maybe you can't even legislate around that. If you're going to put people on local election boards who are just going to certify the election for Trump or the Republican, no matter what the vote is, I don't know what is the answer to that. And then it's up to the local Justice Department official or the local law enforcement official to enforce that. They want to side with Trump too. I mean, you can see how this exposed serious problems with democracy if people will not stand up for the rule of law and what's right.
One more call. Tom and Edison, you're on WNYC with congressional correspondent from the New York Times, Luke Broadwater. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There was a memo released a couple months ago detailing the plan for Pence to throw out ballots and lie that there was some election controversy in certain states. I've never heard anyone talk about issuing a subpoena to Mike Pence to make him testify as to who was pressuring him to do that. It seems to me that he probably wouldn't resist such a subpoena. He has no reason to continue to be loyal to Trump. And if someone was pressuring him, isn't that evidence of a conspiracy to commit election fraud?
Right. So we do know that some of Pence's inner circle are cooperating with the January 6th committee. And we do know from reporting in my paper and elsewhere that the pressure campaign for Pence went up to the top. We know that Trump personally called him right before the vote on January 6th and, you know, used an expletive demanding that he throw out the legitimate votes of voters. He used a vulgarity trying to pressure him, and that Pence decided not to go along with it. And so we do know that went all the way to the top. The memo you're talking about is by a lawyer named John Eastman, and he has been subpoenaed by the January 6th committee. He has filed a lawsuit against them to try to block his records from being turned over. And he's also said he will plead the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination in response to their questions. So they are digging down that hole. Pence himself is in a politically weird situation. He obviously was threatened by the mob. They chanted to kill him, to hang him. And at the same time as he did do the right thing in the moment and didn't go along with this plot, he has since said things trying to minimize January 6th, talking about being loyal to Trump, and that this was a small disagreement between them, and really the Trump-Pence agenda was much broader. So because he wants a future in the Republican Party. So his situation politically is quite strained and tortured and contorted based on January 6th and his broader goals to try to remain a leader in the Republican Party.
As a closing thought, cycling back to what you said a few minutes ago about them needing to undo the filibuster, at least for this, if the federal government is going to protect people's voting rights in terms of their votes actually being respected when they've elected somebody who the Republicans don't like, it's at least as big a Joe Manchin issue as his blocking of President Biden's child care and elder care and family leave human infrastructure bill. Isn't it that Manchin won't support a vote to get around the filibuster just on the fundamental issue of voting rights? Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York was on the show yesterday saying basically, please, Joe, please, Senator Manchin, just on this one issue, because it's so fundamental to preserving our democracy, we can keep the filibuster for everything else for now. So without that, there's nothing Congress can do to protect election integrity in the respect that we've been discussing. It would be up to the states.
It does seem that way. Now, what is it? The crazy thing about Senate rules is they're all made up. Like the Byrd rule's made up, the filibuster's made up, and they can change them. And we just saw it this week. They did a carve out to the filibuster for the debt ceiling because the Republicans didn't want to vote it, but Mitch McConnell realized it would be calamitous for the country to not have the debt ceiling be raised and to default on the debt. So he allowed he negotiated a carve out to the filibuster on that specific issue. No Republicans had to vote for the debt ceiling increase, and still the fiscally responsible thing was done. Huh. Could a similar deal be struck on voting rights? That remains to be seen. It doesn't look positive, in my opinion, based on my read of the playing field. But I've been wrong before. And if Joe Manchin and Sinema and some of the other centrist Democrats who have not wanted to change the filibuster went along with it, then it's possible they could do a carve out on that specific issue.
Luke Water, congressional correspondent. Luke Broadwater, congressional correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, A Daily Politics Podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.